Welcome to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, bringing you fiction, nonfiction, and other readings with a local connection. This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Material is selected with interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. I'm Joanne, and today I will be reading from The Summer Club by Hannah McKinnon. This is episode 9, and it will be the last episode. It's a short ending, so I'll also read a little short story from Jhumpa Lahiri, who was born in London but grew up in Rhode Island. So here we go. "Everyone stand back," the officers shouted. "Sir, take your kid back inside now." "Honey, we have to get back in the house," Ned urged. "You're having him arrested because of Vince? You can't let them do this." Everything was spiraling out of control. Ned had to get his daughter safely back inside. "Now," he shouted, and Darcy blanched but obeyed. He was about to follow when one of the corner of his eye became aware of something large and fast-moving. Before Ned realized what was happening, Stan was upon him. "You called the cops on my kid?" Stan towered over him, and Ned stumbled backward on his own front steps. Stan halted at the bottom of the steps, but he looked ready to come up and kill Ned. "How could you do this?" he shouted. "He's innocent, you son of a gun." Two of the officers were right behind him. "I'm going," Stan told them, holding out his arms and stepping back. "I'm sorry, I'm going." He walked with them back to his own yard. Ned collapsed on the front step. This was so much worse than he imagined. One officer remained by the RV, standing patrol between the Crenshaw's yard and the Birches, ensuring everyone stayed on their own side. Meanwhile, neighbors stood at the edges of their yards, some huddled down the street talking and pointing. All of Maple Street was watching. It was time to go inside. Ned had pulled himself to his feet when he heard the sound of metal on metal. The sound was grisly, like someone being struck repeatedly. It was coming from down his own driveway. Ned hurried back down the steps. There in front of the garage was Darcy. She stood over a pile of glittering metal with his sledgehammer in her grip. Ned took a step toward her as she swung it skyward. It wasn't easy. The hammer was heavy and Darcy was slight, but her strength was as impressive as it was gruesome. Frozen, Ned stared at his daughter, hauled the hammer up, and brought it down. The object that was its target exploded with the blow, gold and silver fragments spiraling in all directions. Ned started to run. He ran toward his daughter as she lifted the handle again. He ran through the shards of plastic and metal, skittering across the pavement and crunching beneath his feet. And then he stopped. What once were Darcy's gold trophies lay in a heap of her feet. A dazzling display of metallic fragments, and then it hit him. The truth hit Ned Birch like a cannonball in the middle of his driveway. Darcy's abandoned love of the game, her distant disposition, her ambivalence and anger that summer, the look on her face the other day when he asked her to help Vince teach the campers a golf lesson. The look on Vince's face later that same day when he convinced Ned not to call the police, that he'd be happy to just let it go. And lastly, the anonymous comments in the Pilgrim box. "People should feel safe here." A flame of conflagrated in Ned's brain as he stared at his daughter standing in the glittering pile of wreckage. Darcy let go of the sledgehammer. The handle clattered to the pavement. "Darcy," he whispered. He had missed all of it, right there in his own house and at his own place of work, with his own child. He had failed. Ned Birch had failed them all. Distraught, he did the only thing he could. He opened his arms. "Stop!" It was Adam. Adam appeared at the back gate, struggling with the latch. "Open the gate," he cried. "I have to stop them." Ned realized he meant the police car that had backed out of Crenshaw's driveway. His gaze swung hard to the cruiser, pulling away slowly. Flick Creevy's head bowed in the back seat. The gate latch popped, and Adam burst through, racing toward the street. In the middle of his driveway, Ned Birch felt his heart split in half. Which child did he reach for first? Adam! Darcy screamed after her brother. But he was too fast, and he slipped past them both. Ned took off after him. By then, Adam had run in the street, blocking the path of the car. The cruiser screeched to a stop. Heart in his throat, Ned shouted to his son to stand still. The siren whooped. Adam froze. He threw his hands up in the air. Take me, he shouted. And then he did the saddest thing Ned would ever witness in his whole life. His 15-year-old son kneeled down in the road in front of their house, hands on his head. Flick, didn't do it, he cried. Take me. All summer, Adam had been watching. He wondered why his big sister had suddenly quit golf, the thing she loved that had consumed just about every warm, sunny day as long as Adam could remember. When he thought of Darcy, he pictured her in a visor, her nose dotted with sunscreen, heading out to the course with their father. He'd watch Darcy win all those trophies and then take them all down. He saw where she hid them, first in the back of her closet and later down in a box in the dusty garage. It wasn't just the trophies. There were times Darcy was agitated in the car on the drive home from the club, when Adam sat beside her in the passenger seat and her leg jigged the whole way, always after a lesson with Vince. It made him worry about his big sister. He worried so much that he started watching her closer, sometimes following her, trying to see what was really the matter. Adam saw what happened in the shed that day, how Darcy had been hanging up golf bags on the rack when Vince came up behind her, how Vince reached around his sister and pressed his hips against her. Adam knew that was not right. From the window, he watched his sister spin around and away. He saw her mouth moving, but could not make out the words. He hoped they were swears. When she raced out of the shed crying, Adam felt something inside him snap. All that day he tried. He tried to ask Darcy about it. He tried to talk to his parents, but no one listened. Vince and the club were hurting his sister, and nobody would listen to him. So Adam did something louder, something no one could ignore. He knew Flick kept his keys in his car. Adam had admired that car all summer. The rest was easy, because no one was paying attention. Friday evening. The Delancey wedding rehearsal dinner started at 5:30. 30 minutes before the official times, the big red fishery truck, delivering 200 Hikarimono koi, finally pulled into the clubhouse parking lot. As pictures of blue and white hydrangea were placed on linen-covered tables on the upper deck, the fishery driver ran a long hose from the tank of the truck across the first fairway and down to the pond. Beeswax taper candles were placed in sparkling silver candlesticks as the truck pumped suctioned water across the greens and into the tanks. Guests in summer whites in gauzy dress trickled in as a funny-looking orange chute was hooked up to a truck and unraveled across the clubhouse yard and down the hill to the pond. The guests were intrigued. What was this funny-looking tube? What was happening here? High up, above it all, on the upper deck, a father posed for a picture with his beautiful bride-to-be daughter, while a slew of fish slapped their tails against the holding tanks. It was time. Just before the chute was opened, one last car pulled into the Mayhaven parking lot. Ned Birch was not dressed for a rehearsal dinner, nor was he invited, but he joined the sea of guests traversing the lawn adjacent to the strange orange tube and headed for the clubhouse. When the fishery truck operator opened the chute, there was a primitive gurgle followed by a deafening rush of water. Newly sprung, the fish surged down the chute that ran alongside the heels and loafers of the guest, who marveled at the noise. We should walk down to the pond to see, someone said. Among them, Ned Birch kept his eyes trained ahead. Despite the fact he waited all summer for this, he was oblivious to the chute and fish. Ned was looking for someone. Suddenly, without warning, there came a strange geyser-like sound. The chute that snaked across the clubhouse lawn shuddered and burst open. As guests covered their faces and leapt away from the spray, Ned Birch made a beeline for the man he had been looking for. Down on the lawns, the orange chute twisted and rolled like a mythological snake, spitting fish and water in equal measure across the grass. As the driver shouted for help, Ned Birch ran at the golf pro. Vince, having just raised his chin to empty his flute of champagne, lowered it, just in time for Ned Birch to sock him square in the face. Someone screamed. Vince toppled backward into a champagne tower, glass and bubbles erupting everywhere. In the background, a sea of fish flipped and floundered across the flooded greens as groundskeeping scrambled for buckets. When Vince staggered to his feet, Ned punched him again for good measure. By then, staff and few brave guests were scooping fish into wheelbarrows. A quick thinker secured the hose. Someone else brought snow shovels. Clutching his bloodied knuckles, Ned Birch strode across the soaked lawns of Mayhaven, staring around the disarray of guest and groundskeeper. Careful not to tread upon flailing fish, he got in his car. For the first time all summer, he turned on the radio and sang the whole way home. Epilogue. Darcy. Secrets she had learned are sharp objects to hold. Still, there are reasons people try. Sometimes it is to protect yourself. Sometimes it is to protect the ones you love, and sometimes it is out of shame. When she looks back on the summer, Darcy understands that she was guilty of all three. She also understands now that she was guilty of nothing other than trying to keep that secret. What happened to her, rather, what someone did to her, was not her fault, and she wishes she had believed that back then. Finally, now, she does. Darcy will never forget the awfulness of that day when the police came to the neighbors. It is engraved on her heart. After Flick was cleared and after Adam came home from being questioned at the police station with her parents, her father went out. He did not tell anyone where he was going, and he was not gone very long. They were all sitting at the kitchen table, her mother, Adam, and her. When the front door banged open, no one was startled. They already had enough scares for the day. As her father stood in the doorway, blanched and sweaty, Darcy suddenly understood where he'd been. When he walked into the kitchen, eyes only for her, Darcy felt the chair fly out from under her. She doesn't remember running to him or falling into his arms. What she does remember, when she thinks back on that moment, was that it was finally over. "Please forgive me," he cried, clenching to his chest. "I'm so sorry, Darcy. I am so sorry." That's the sharpest part of a secret you try to hold back, the sorrow, because it's the sorrow that draws blood. Darcy hadn't wanted her parents to hurt like she did. What she had come to learn is that sharing your burdens with others is like wind on a mountain and water on stone. Little by little, that sorrow is eroded by all the hands that touch it. To every passing between hands, it is molded, so that by the time you lift it to the light, you realize all the jagged edges had been worn down, and then, finally, you can let go. Darcy did not have to share her secret with Flick Creevy. Eventually, Flick understood it for himself, and in trying to be a good friend, he kept her secret. But only for a little while, he later told her. Because good friends won't let you hold on to a hurt for too long, even when you ask them. Good friends will tell your secret if they love you enough. When they talk now, Flick doesn't ask her how she feels. These days, he sees so much of Darcy that he knows the answer to that, too. High school has started. It's a new year, and when they hold hands in the hallways, people look at them. Darcy tells him it's because they both look happy. Flick tells her it's because they can't believe what a lucky guy he is. There is one trophy left that did not get smashed that fateful day in the driveway. Somehow it toppled to the side and escaped her rage. For now, she keeps it in the garage. She will probably never put it back in her room again, but her mother has convinced her to hang on to it. It's a sign of what she's accomplished. And when she looks at it now, Darcy doesn't just think of the winds. Flick. This school is nicer than his old one, he tells Mateo. Josie was right about that, at least. His classes are hard, but he's working harder. It's time to adjust to life in Rockwood, so he may as well commit. He's made a few new friends, though no one like Mateo. Mateo's coming to visit him next weekend. His mother and Stan are taking them to the country club for dinner, their new country club, Fox Run. Hope that country club is ready for me, Mateo texts him one night after school. Same for Lambo. Over Stan's dead body. How is the king? Not so bad. How's the girl? Even better. Two things happened after the police showed up that day. First, Stan went to bat for him like no one ever did, besides his mother. Stan pulled out of Mayhaven, got Flick a lawyer, which he thankfully didn't need, and stuck up for him in front of the police and Mr. Birch. Flick feels bad for Mr. Birch. That summer, he got a lot of bad news about people and the place he loved. Flick has come to realize some people only see the good around them because that's what they need to see. Rockwood isn't exactly the place his mother hoped it would be, but Darcy makes him want to give it a chance. The second thing that happened, which he still can't quite believe, was that the Birches finally came over. Stan threw a big Labor Day party in the backyard with a DJ and caterers in a whole bit. Flick didn't blame Mr. Birch for not liking Stan. Stan had been a bully. But when Ned Birch rang the doorbell holding a box of cookies, just like he did that first day, Flick was floored. The Birches didn't stay late, and Ned didn't dance. Ingrid did. But a couple days later, Stan moved the RV. It stored in the lot across town. Gestures matter, Flick realizes. He thinks about this as he picks a bunch of wildflowers on the walk over to Darcy's house. He's taking her out to dinner. After, he takes Adam for a ride in his car. Ned. His father is not a good father, Ned knows. He was not a kind or pleasant man to be around, especially to those who had the misfortune of sharing a roof with him. As far as Ned is concerned, the only worthwhile lesson his father taught him was this: there's grace in golf. Ned had long thought that the sport he loved and devoted his career to, and later shared with his daughter, was where the grace could be found. But he is finding grace off the course, too. Ned is not sure what he will do next, but he knows his family will manage until he figures it out, thanks to Ingrid and her determination and the magic at the treehouse sale. Ned used to see himself as the head of Mayhaven, a place once dear to him, and one he thought dear to his family. His blind spots have been varied. When he thinks of Ingrid, he sees her at the helm of their family, unwavering despite the roughness of the sea or the strength of the storm. Their family is a haven, and there is no association or club on earth he'd rather be a member of. Adam has a new job at Ingrid's realty office where he works designing online listings. He has not been allowed to watch YouTube card videos since the golf course incident, but he did clean Flick's car top to bottom and made apologies. Mayhaven has agreed to forego the repayment of the damages for the Birches agreeing not to sue the club. At first, Ned cannot bring himself to accept those terms. He wanted to see Vince suffer, but after legal and financial counsel, he had made peace with the idea and found a happy workaround. Still a respected man in the industry, Ned had shared their story with those who need to know. Vince will have a hard time finding work or playing any course in the area again, just as Ned will have a hard time ever forgiving himself. As Darcy always said, Adam sees and hears everything. Ned will try to be more like Adam. Ned was relieved when Darcy agreed to therapy, at his and Ingrid's urging, another small grace. But his greatest relief was a few weeks ago, when she pulled her dusty bag of clubs out of the hallway closet. Now, Once a week on Saturday mornings, Ned knocks on the back door at Fox Run Country Club. He is old friends with the new manager there. The time around, he has permission. Before the club opens, just as the sun begins its slow climb over the hills, the manager waves them in. Together, Ned and Darcy walk the course in the gauzy hour just after dawn. They are both a little rusty, but the game comes back quickly if the words don't. Sometimes they talk about school or family. Sometimes they don't talk at all, but they walk shoulder to shoulder for the love of it, and there is grace in that. And so that's the end of The Summer Club by Hannah McKinnon. Since I finished a lot early, I'll be reading a short story from Jhumpa Lahiri's Interpreter of Maladies. And the short story is, of course, called The Interpreter of Maladies. At the tea stall, Mr. and Mrs. Dawes bickered about who should take Tina to the toilet. Eventually, Mrs. Dawes relented when Mr. Dawes pointed out that he had given the girl her back the night before. In the rearview mirror, Mr. Capasi watched as Mrs. Dawes emerged slowly from his bulky white ambassador, dragging her shaved, largely bare legs across the back seat. She did not hold the little girl's hand as they walked to the restroom. They were on the way to see the Sun Temple at Conorak. It was a dry, bright Saturday, the mid-July heat tempered by a steady ocean breeze, ideal weather for sightseeing. Ordinarily, Mr. Capasi would not have stopped so soon along the way, but less than 5 minutes after he picked up the family that morning in front of Hotel Sandy Villa, the little girl had complained. The first thing Mr. Capasi had noticed when he saw Mr. and Mrs. Dawes standing with their children under the portico of the hotel was that they were very young, perhaps not even 30. In addition to Tina, they had two boys, Ronnie and Bobby, who appeared very close in age and had teeth covered in the network of flashing silver wires. The family looked Indian, but dressed as foreigners did. The children in stiff, brightly colored clothing and caps with translucent visors. Mr. Capasi was accustomed to foreign tourists. He was assigned to them regularly because he could speak English. Yesterday, he had driven an elderly couple from Scotland, both with spotted faces and fluffy white hair so thin it exposed their sunburnt scalps. In comparison, the tanned, youthful faces of Mr. and Mrs. Dawes were all the more striking. When he introduced himself, Mr. Capasi had pressed his palms together in greeting, but Mr. Dawes squeezed hands like an American so that Mr. Capasi felt it in his elbow. Mrs. Dawes, for her part, had flexed one side of her mouth, smiling dutifully at Mr. Capasi without displaying any interest in him. As they waited at the tea stall, Ronnie, who looked like the older of the two boys, clambered suddenly out of the back seat, intrigued by a goat tied to a stake in the ground. "Don't touch it," Mr. Dawes said. He glanced up from his paperback tour book, which said India in yellow letters and looked as if it had been published abroad. His voice, somehow tentative and a little shrill, sounded as though it had not yet settled into maturity. "I want to give it a piece of gum," the boy called back as he trotted ahead. Mr. Dawes stepped out of the car and stretched his legs by squatting briefly to the ground. A clean-shaven man, he looked exactly like a magnified version of Ronnie. He had a sapphire blue visor and was dressed in shorts, sneakers, and a T-shirt. The camera slung around his neck with an impressive telephoto lens and numerous buttons and markings was the only complicated thing he wore. He frowned, watching as Ronnie rushed toward the goat, but appeared to have no intentions of intervening. "Bobby, make sure your brother doesn't do anything stupid." "I don't feel like it," Bobby said, not moving. He was sitting in the front seat beside Mr. Capasi, studying a picture of the elephant god taped to the glove compartment. "No need to worry," Mr. Capasi said. They are quite tame. Mr. Capazzi was 46 years old, with receding hair that had gone completely silver. But his butterscotch complexion and his unlined brow, which he treated in spare moments to dabs of lotus oil balm, made it easy to imagine what he must have looked like at an earlier age. He wore gray trousers and a matching jacket-style shirt, tapered at the waist, with short sleeves and a large pointed collar, made of the thin but durable synthetic material. He had specified both the cut and the fabric to his tailor. It was his preferred uniform for giving tours because it did not get crushed during his long hours behind the wheel. Through the windshield, he watched as Ronnie circled around the boat, touched it quickly on its side, then trotted back to the car. "You left India as a child?" Mr. Capazzi asked when Mr. Das had settled once again into the passenger seat. "Oh, Mina and I were both born in America," Mr. Das announced with an air of sudden confidence. "Born and raised. Our parents live here now, in Asinaw. They retired. We visit them every couple years." He turned to watch as the little girl ran toward the car, the wide purple brows of her sundress flopping on her narrow brown shoulders. She was holding to her chest a doll with yellow hair that looked as if it had been chopped as a punitive measure with a pair of dull scissors. "This is Tina's first trip to India, isn't it, Tina?" "I don't have to go to the bathroom anymore," Tina announced. "Where's Mina?" Mr. Das asked. Mr. Capazzi found it strange that Mr. Das should refer to his wife by her first name when speaking to the little girl. Tina pointed to where Mrs. Das was purchasing something from one of the shirtless men who worked at the tea stall. Mr. Capazzi heard one of the shirtless men sing a phrase from a popular Hindi love song as Mrs. Das walked back to the car, but she did not appear to understand the words of the song, for she did not express irritation or embarrassment, or react in the other way to the man's declarations. He observed her. She wore a red and white checkered skirt that stopped above her knees, slip-on shoes with a square wooden heel, and a close-fitting blouse styled like a man's undershirt. The blouse was decorated at chest level with a calico applique in the shape of a strawberry. She was a short woman with small hands like paws, with frosty pink fingernails painted to match her lips, and was slightly plump in her figure. Her hair, shown only a little longer than her husband's, was parted far to one side. She was wearing large dark brown sunglasses with a pinkish tint to them, and carried a big straw bag almost as big as her torso, shaped like a bowl, with a water bottle poking out of it. She walked slowly, carrying some puffed rice tossed with peanuts and chili peppers in a large packet made from newspapers. Mr. Capazzi turned to Mr. Das. "Where in America do you live?"
"New Brunswick, New Jersey."
"Next to New York?"
"Exactly. I teach middle school there."
"What subject?"
"Science.
In fact, every year I take my students on a trip to the Museum of Natural History in New York City. In a way, we have a lot in common, you could say, you and I." "How long have you been a tour guide, Mr. Capazzi?"
5 years.
Mrs. Das reached the car. "How long's the trip?" she asked, shutting the door.
"About 2.5 hours, Mr. Capazzi replied.
At this, Mrs. Das gave an impatient sigh, as she had been traveling her whole life without pause. She fanned herself with a folded Bombay film magazine written in English. "I thought that the Sun Temple is only 18 miles north of Puri," Mr. Das said, tapping on the tour book. "The roads to Konarak are poor." "Actually, it is a distance of 52 miles, Mr. Capazzi explained. Mr. Das nodded, readjusting the camera strap where it had begun to chafe the back of his neck. Before starting the ignition, Mr. Capazzi reached back to make sure the crank-like locks on the inside of each of the back doors were secured. As soon as the car began to move, the little girl began to play with the lock on her side, clicking it with some effort forward and backward,
But Mrs. Dash said nothing to stop her. She sat a little bit slouched at one end of the back seat, not offering her puffed rice to anyone. Ronnie and Tina sat on the other side of her, both snapping bright green gum. "Look," Bobby said as the car began to gather speed. He pointed with his finger to the tall trees that lined the road. "Look, monkeys!" Ronnie shrieked. "Wow!" They were seated in groups along the branches, with shining black faces, silver bodies, horizontal eyebrows, and crested heads. Their long gray tails dangled like a series of ropes among the leaves. A few scratched themselves with black leather hands or swung their feet, staring at the car as the car passed. "We call them the Hanuman," Mr. Kabazi said. "They are quite common in this area." As he spoke, one of the monkeys leapt into the middle of the road, causing Mr. Kabazi to brake suddenly. Another bounced onto the hood of the car, then sprang away. Mr. Kabazi beeped his horn. The children began to get excited, sucking in their breath and covering their faces partly with their hands. They had never seen monkeys outside of a zoo, Mr. Das explained. He asked Mr. Kabazi to stop the car so that he could take a picture. While Mr. Das adjusted his telephoto lens, Mrs. Das reached into her straw bag and pulled out a bottle of colorless nail polish, which she proceeded to stroke on the tip of her index fingers. The little girl stuck out a hand. "Mine too, Mommy. Do mine too." "Leave me alone," Mrs. Das said, blowing on her nails and turning the bodice light. "You're making me mess up." The little girl occupied herself by buttoning and unbuttoning a pinafore on the doll's plastic body. "All set," Mr. Das said, replacing the lens cap. The car rattled considerably as it raced along the dusty road, causing them all to pop up from their seats every now and then. But Mrs. Das continued to polish her nails. Mr. Kabazi eased up on the accelerator, hoping to produce a smoother ride. When he reached for the gear shift, the boy in the front accommodated him by swinging his hairless knees out of the way. Mr. Kabazi noted that this boy was slightly paler than the other children. "Daddy, why is the driver sitting on the wrong side in this car, too?" the boy asked. "They all do that here, dummy," Ronnie said. "Don't call your brother a dummy," Mr. Das said. He turned to Mr. Kabazi. "In America, you know, it confuses them." "Oh, yes, I am well aware," Mr. Kabazi said. As delicately as he could, he shifted gears again, accelerating as they approached a hill in the road. "I see it on Dallas. The steering wheels are on the left side." "What's Dallas?" Tina asked, banging her now naked doll on the seat behind Mr. Kabazi. "It went off the air," Mr. Das explained. "It's a television show." They were all like siblings, Mr. Kabazi thought, as they passed a row of date trees. Mr. and Mrs. Das behaved like an older brother and sister, not parents. It seemed they were in charge of the children only for the day. It was hard to believe they were regularly responsible for anything other than themselves. Mr. Das tapped on his lens cap and his tour book, dragging his thumbnail occasionally across the pages so that they made a scraping sound. Mrs. Das continued to polish her nails. She had still not removed her sunglasses. Every now and then, Tina renewed her plea that she wanted her nails done, too. And so at one point, Mrs. Das flicked a drop of polish on the little girl's finger before depositing the bottle back inside her straw bag. "Isn't this an air-conditioned car?" she asked, still blowing on her hand. The window on Tina's side was broken and could not be rolled down. "Quit complaining," Mr. Das said. "It isn't so hot." "I told you to get a car with air conditioning," Mrs. Das continued. "Why do you do this, Raj? Just to save a few stupid rupees? What are you saving us, 50 cents? Their accents sounded like the ones Mr. Kabazi heard on American television programs, though not like the ones on Dallas. "Doesn't it get tiresome, Mr. Kabazi, showing people the same thing every day?" Mr. Das asked, rolling down his own window all the way. "Hey, do you mind stopping the car? I just want to get a shot of this guy." Mr. Capazzi pulled over to the side of the road as Mr. Das took a picture of a barefoot man, his head wrapped in a dirty turban, seated on top of a cart of grain sacks pulled by a pair of bullocks. Both the man and the bullocks were emaciated. In the back seat, Mrs. Das gazed out another window at the sky, where nearly transparent clouds passed quickly in front of one another. "I look forward to it, actually," Mr. Capazzi said as they continued on their way. "The Sun Temple is one of my favorite places, and that way it is a reward for me. I give tours on Fridays and Saturdays only. I have another job during the week." "Oh, where?" Mr. Das asked. "I work in a doctor's office." "You're a doctor?" "I am not a doctor. I work with one, as an interpreter." "What does a doctor need an interpreter for?" "He has a number of Gujarati patients. My father was a Gujarati, but many people do not speak Gujarati in this area, including the doctor. And so the doctor asked me to work in his office, interpreting what the patients say." "Interesting. I never heard anything like that," Mr. Das said. Mr. Capazzi shrugged. "It is a job like any other." "But so romantic," Mrs. Das said dreamily, breaking her extended silence. She lifted her pinkish-brown sunglasses and arranged them on top of her head like a tiara. For the first time, her eyes met Mr. Capazzi's in the rearview mirror, pale, a bit small, their gaze fixed but drowsy. Mr. Das craned to look at her. "What's so romantic about it?" "I don't know, something," she shrugged, knitting her brows together for an instant. "Would you like a piece of gum, Mr. Capazzi?" she asked brightly. She reached into a straw bag and handed him a small square wrapped in green and white striped paper. As soon as Mr. Capazzi put the gum in his mouth, a thick, sweet liquid burst onto his tongue. "Tell us more about your job, Mr. Capazzi," Mrs. Das said. "What would you like to know?" "Madame?" "I don't know," she shrugged, munching on some popped rice and licking the mustard oil from the corners of her mouth. "Tell us a typical situation." She settled back in her seat, her head tilted in a patch of sun, and closed her eyes. "I want to picture what happens." "Very well. The other day, a man came in with a pain in his throat." "Did he smoke cigarettes?" "No. It was very curious. He complained that he felt as if there were long pieces of straw stuck in his throat. When I told the doctor, he was able to prescribe the proper medication." "That's so neat." "Yes," Mr. Capazzi agreed after some hesitation. "So these patients are totally dependent on you," Mrs. Das said. She spoke slowly, as if she were thinking aloud. "In a way, more dependent on you than the doctor." "How do you mean? How could it be?" "Well, for example, you could tell the doctor that the pain felt like a burning, not straw. The patient will never know what you told the doctor, and the doctor will know that you told the wrong thing. It's a big responsibility." "Yes, a big responsibility you have there, Mr. Capazzi," Mr. Das agreed. Mr. Capazzi had never thought of his job in such complimentary terms. To him, it was a thankless occupation. He found nothing noble in interpreting people's maladies, assiduously translating the symptoms of so many swollen bones, countless cramps of bellies and bowels, spots on people's palms that change color, shape, or size. The doctor, nearly half his age, had an affinity for bell-bottom trousers and made humorless jokes about the Congress party. Together, they worked in a stale little infirmary where Mr. Capazzi's smartly tailored clothes clung to him in the heat, in spite of the blackened blades of a ceiling fan churning over their heads. The job was a sign of his failings. In his youth, he'd been a devoted scholar of foreign languages, the owner of an impressive collection of dictionaries. He had dreamed of being an interpreter for diplomats and dignitaries, resolving conflicts between people and nations, settling disputes of which he alone could understand both sides. He was self-educated. In a series of notebooks, in the evenings before his parents settled his marriage, he had listed the common etymologies of words. And at one point in his life, he was confident that he could converse if given the opportunity, in English, French, Russian, Portuguese, and Italian, not to mention Hindi, Bengali, or Isi in Gujarati. Now only a handful of European phrases remained in his memory, scattered words with things like saucers and chairs. English was the only non-Indian language he spoke fluently anymore. Mr. Capazzi knew it was not a remarkable talent. Sometimes he feared that his children knew better English than he did, just from watching television. Still, it came in handy for the tours. He had taken the job as an interpreter after his first son, at the age of 7, contracted typhoid. That was how he had first made the acquaintance of the doctor. At the time, Mr. Capazzi had been teaching English in a grammar school, and he bartered his skills as an interpreter to pay the increasingly exorbitant medical bills. In the end, the boy had died one evening in his mother's arms, his limbs burning with fever. But then there was the funeral to pay for, and the other children who were born soon enough, and the newer, bigger house, and the good schools and tutors, and the fine shoes and the television, and the countless other ways he tried to console his wife and to keep her from crying in her sleep. And so when the doctor offered to pay him twice as much as he earned at the grammar school, he accepted. Mr. Capazzi knew that his wife had little regard for his career as an interpreter. He knew it reminded her of the son she'd lost, and that she resented the other lives he'd helped, in his own small way, to save. If ever she referred to his position, she used the phrase doctor's assistant, as if the process of interpretation was equal to taking someone's temperature or changing a bed payment. She never asked him about the patients who came to the doctor's office, or said that his job was a big responsibility. For this reason, it flattered Mr. Capazzi that Mrs. Das was so intrigued by his job. Unlike his wife, she had reminded him of his intellectual challenges. She had also used the word romantic. She did not behave in a romantic way toward her husband, and yet she had used the word to describe him. He wondered if Mr. and Mrs. Das was a bad match, just as he and his wife were. Perhaps they, too, had little in common apart from 3 children and a decade of their lives. The signs he recognized from his own marriage were there, the bickering, the indifference, the protracted silence. Her sudden interest in him, an interest she did not express in either her husband or her children, were mildly intoxicating. When Mr. Capazzi thought once again about how she had said romantic, the feeling of intoxication grew. He began to check his reflection in the rearview mirror as he drove, feeling grateful that he had chosen the gray suit that morning and not the brown one, which tended to sag a little in the knees. From time to time, he glanced through the mirror at Mrs. Das. In addition to glancing at her face, he glanced at the strawberry between her breasts and the golden brown hollow in her throat. He decided to tell Mrs. Das about another patient and another, the young woman who had complained of a sensation of raindrops in her spine, the gentleman whose birthmark had begun to sprout hairs. Mrs. Das listened attentively, stroking her heel with a small plastic brush that resembled an oval bed of nails, asking more questions for yet another example. The children were quiet, intent on spotting more monkeys in the trees, and Mr. Das was absorbed by his own tour book, so it seemed like a private conversation between Mr. Capazzi and Mrs. Das. In this manner, the next half hour passed, and when they stopped for lunch at a roadside restaurant that sold fritters and omelet sandwiches, usually something Mr. Capazzi looked forward to on his tours, so that he could sit in peace and enjoy some hot tea, he was disappointed. As the Das family settled together under a magenta umbrella fringed with white and orange tassels, and placed their orders with one of the waiters who marched about in tri-cornered caps, Mr. Capazzi reluctantly headed toward a neighboring table. "Mr. Capazzi, wait! There's room here," Mrs. Das called out. She gathered onto her lap, insisting that he accompany them. And so, together, they had bottled mango juice in sandwiches and plates of onions and potato, deep-fried in graham flour batter. After finishing two omelet sandwiches, Mr. Das took more pictures of the group as they ate. "How much longer?" he asked Mr. Capasse as he paused to load a new roll of film in the camera. "About half an hour more." By now, the children had gotten up from the table to look at more monkeys perched in a nearby tree, so there was a considerable space between Mrs. Das and Mr. Capasse. Mr. Das placed the camera to his face and squeezed one eye shut, his tongue exposed at one corner of his mouth. "This looks funny, Mina. You need to lean in closer to Mr. Capasse." She did. He could smell a scent on her skin, like a mixture of whiskey and rose water. He worried suddenly that she could smell his perspiration, which he knew had collected beneath the synthetic material of his shirt. He polished off his mango juice in one gulp and smoothed his silver hair with his hands. A bit of juice dripped onto his chin. He wondered if Mrs. Das had noticed. She had not. "What's your address, Mr. Capasse?" she inquired, fishing for something inside her straw bag. "You would like my address?" "So we can send you copies," she said, "of the pictures." She handed him a scrap of paper, which she had hastily ripped from a page of her film magazine. The blank portion was limited, for the narrow strip was crowded by lines of text and a tiny picture of a hero and heroine embracing under a eucalyptus tree. The paper curled as Mr. Capasse wrote his address in clear, careful letters. She would write to him, asking about his days, interpreting at the doctor's office, and he would respond eloquently, choosing only the most entertaining anecdotes, ones that would make her laugh out loud as she read them in her house in New Jersey. In time, she would reveal the disappointment of her marriage and he in his. In this way, their friendship would grow and flourish. He would possess a picture of the two of them, eating fried onions under a magenta umbrella, which he would keep, he decided, safely tucked between the pages of his Russian grammar. It was similar to a feeling he used to experience long ago when, after months of translating with the aid of a dictionary, he would finally read a passage from a French novel or an Italian sonnet and understand the words, one after another, unencumbered by his own efforts. In those moments, Mr. Capasse used to believe that all was right with the world, that all the struggles were rewarded, that all of life's mistakes made sense in the end. The promise that he would hear from Mrs. Dodds now filled him with the same belief. When he finished writing his address, Mr. Capasse handed her the paper, but as soon as he did so, he worried that he had either misspelled his name or accidentally reversed the numbers of his postal code. He dreaded the possibility of a lost letter, the photograph never reaching him, hovering somewhere in Arisa, close but ultimately unattainable. He thought of asking for the slip of paper again, just to make sure he had written his address accurately, but Mrs. Das had already dropped it into the jumble of her bit bag. They reached Konarak at 2:30. The temple, made of sandstone, was a massive pyramid-like structure in the shape of a chariot. It was dedicated to the great master of life, the sun, which struck three sides of the edifice as it made its journey each day across the sky. 24 giant wheels were carved on the north and south sides of the plinth. The whole thing was drawn by a team of 7 horses, speeding as if through the heavens. As they approached, Mr. Capasse explained that the temple had been built between A.D. 1243 and 1255. With the efforts of the 1,200 artisans by the great ruler of Ganga dynasty, King Narasimha Adiva, the first to commemorate his victory against the Muslim army. It says the temple occupies about 170 acres of land, Mr. Das said, reading from his book. "It's like a desert, Ronnie said, his eyes wandering across the sand that stretched on all sides beyond the temple. The Sandragaba River was once flowed 1 mile north of here. It is dry now, Mr. Kapasi said, turning off the engine. They got out and walked toward the temple, posing first for pictures by the pair of lions that flanked the steps. Mr. Kapasi led them next to one of the wheels of the chariot, higher than any human being, 9 feet in diameter. The wheels are supposed to symbolize the wheel of life, Mr. Dash read. They depict the cycle of creation, preservation, and achievement of realization. Cool. He turned the page of his book. Each wheel is divided into 8 thick and thin spokes, dividing the day into 8 equal parts. The rims are carved with designs of birds and animals, where the medallions in the spokes are carved with women in luxurious poses, largely erotic in nature. What he referred to were the countless friezes of entwined naked bodies making love in various positions, women clinging to the necks of men, their knees wrapped eternally around their lovers' thighs. In addition to these were assorted scenes from daily life, of hunting and trading, of deer being killed with bows and arrows, and marching warriors holding swords in their hands. It was no longer possible to enter the temple, for it had filled with the rubble years ago, but they admired the exterior, as did all the tourists Mr. Kapasi brought there. Slowly strolling along the each of its sides, Mr. Das trailed behind, taking pictures. The children ran ahead, pointing to the figures of naked people, intrigued in particular by the Nagamithas, the half-human, half-serpentine couples who were said, Mr. Kapasi told them, to live in the deepest waters of the sea. Mr. Kapasi was pleased that they liked the temple, pleased especially that it appealed to Mrs. Das. She stopped every 3 or 4 paces, staring silently at the carved lovers and the processions of elephants and the topless female musicians beating on 2-sided drums. Though Mr. Kapasi had been to the temple countless times, it occurred to him, as he, too, gazed at the topless woman, that he had never seen his own wife fully naked. Even when they had made love, she kept the panels of her blouse hooked together, the string of her petticoat knotted around her waist. He had never admired the backs of his wife's legs the way he now admired those of Mrs. Das, walking as if for his benefit alone. He had, of course, seen plenty of bare limbs before, belonging to American and European ladies who took to his tours, but Mrs. Das was different. Unlike the other woman, who had an interest only in the temple and kept their noses buried in a guidebook, or their eyes behind the lens of a camera, Mrs. Das had taken an interest in him. Mr. Kapasi was anxious to be alone with her, to continue their private conversation, yet he felt nervous to walk at her side. She was lost behind her sunglasses, ignoring her husband's request that she pose for another picture, walking past her children as if they were strangers. Worried that he might disturb her, Mr. Kapasi walked ahead to admire, as he always did, the 3 life-size bronze avatars of Syria, the sun god, each emerging from its own niche on the temple facade to greet the sun at dawn, noon, and evening. They wore elaborate headdresses, their languid, elongated eyes closed, their bare chests draped with carved chains and amulets, hibiscus petals offering from various previous visits were strewn at their gray-green feet. The last statue on the northern wall of the temple was Mr. Kapasi's favorite. This Shura had a tired expression, weary after a hard day of work, sitting astride a horse with folded legs. Even his horse's eyes were drowsy. Around his body were smaller sculptures of women in pairs, their hips thrust to one side. "Who's that?" Mrs. Das asked. He was startled to see that she was standing beside him. "He is the Astkala Sera,"
Mr. Cabasa said. The setting sun. So in a couple of hours, the sun will set right here. She slipped a foot out of one of her square-heeled shoes, rubbed her toes on the back of her other leg. That is correct. She raised her sunglasses for a moment, then put them back on again. Neat. Mr. Capazzi was not certain exactly what the word suggested, but he had a feeling it was a favorable response. He hoped that Mrs. Das had understood Syria's beauty, his power. Perhaps they would discuss it further in their letters. He would explain things to her, things about India, and she would explain things to him about America. In its own way, this correspondence would fulfill his dream of serving as an interpreter between nations. He looked at her straw bag, delighted that his address lay nestled among its contents. When he pictured her so many thousands of miles away, he plummeted, so much so that he had an overwhelming urge to wrap his arms around her, to freeze with her, even for an instant, in an embrace witnessed by his favorite Syria. But Mrs. Das had already started walking. "When do you return to America?" he asked, trying to sound placid. "In 10 days." He calculated. A week to settle in, a week to develop the pictures, a few days to compose her letter, 2 weeks to get to India by air. According to his schedule, allowing room for delays, he would hear from Mrs. Das in approximately 6 weeks' time. The family was silent as Mr. Capazzi drove them back, a little past 4:30, to Hotel Sandy Villa. The children had bought miniature granite versions of the chariot's wheels at a souvenir stand, and they turned them around in their hands. Mr. Das continued to read his book. Mrs. Das untangled Tina's hair with her brush and divided it into two little ponytails. "Oh, yeah, there's something mentioned about this in the book. Built by Jane King or something. Shall we go then, Mr. Picasso?" he asked. He paused at a turn in the road. "It's to the left." You've been listening to The Backyard Bookshelf, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Joanne. Thank you for listening.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, serving visually and print-impaired listeners since 1987. Audio Journal is a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Low vision and blind persons in the Worcester area are fortunate to have a support group sponsored by the Massachusetts Association for the Blind in Worcester. The group meets monthly at the Worcester Senior Center and provides information and resources to assist with daily living, assistive technology, transportation, and friendship. For more information, please call Marion at 508-754-0672. Again, that telephone number is 508-754-0672.